There's a very simple and absolutely convincing physical explanation for why increasing carbon dioxide in the atmosphere in the quantities that we are doing is going to increase temperatures by the amount that are predicted. I mean, the climate change deniers have always disputed the evidence, but nobody's ever succeeded in explaining why carbon dioxide wouldn't warm the atmosphere, because it's obvious from the physics that it will. So my name's David Mond. I'm a prof actually in the Mathematics Institute in the University of Warwick. I teach maths. I do some research in maths. I have helped graduate students to get their PhDs. But over the last few years, perhaps as I get older, I have taken an interest, or rather I've become more and more worried by climate change. And it seems to me that for an academic, it's something that one can do something about. Now, I'm not an expert on the mathematics of climate. That's an extremely complicated field, which at my advanced years, I'm not going to enter. But what I think I can do is focus on where I think the real problems in dealing with climate change arise, which is in partly public understanding, but also in negotiation. I think that there's a very interesting and very simple analysis which belongs to the area of economics and maths mixed together called game theory. And I've given a talk quite a few times about this, and over the years gradually decided that what we ought to be doing is organizing a module within the university open to everybody, because this is a subject that in some sense draws on every area of expertise. I'm interested in the subject more because I think it's necessary to change the world than to understand it. I think, well, we need to understand it more. We need to understand more about climate change, and we need to understand more about the psychology which prevents the world from coming to grips with it. And we need to devise, above all, methods for overcoming the psychological obstacles. I'm feeling very excited about this, actually. I'm at a fortunate stage in my career because I'm a prof. I'm no longer worried about being promoted, and I don't have to be ambitious. You know, I can think, well, what's really important to me? What do I really want to achieve? And to be honest, although I love my mathematics, my pure math research, what I'd really like to achieve would be something on the climate change front. I would really like to see the university developing its activities and developing awareness in its members and finding ways of reducing its carbon footprint, but ways that can be shared and communicated to the wider world. We've been running now for 3 years a module called Challenges of Climate Change, and what we've done is got people from physics to explain the basic physics, and from life sciences to explain what the consequences of increasing temperatures will be, and people from economics and people from politics to talk about how political change can come and what's stopping it and what economic pressures are. And we've had a person from the business school who's given excellent lectures about innovative and creative work in the business sector on developing new low energy technologies. It's been, I think it's quite successful. To my shock and horror, the course wasn't taken by every student in the university as I assumed it would be, because I think it's a problem that really should concern everybody. And it's actually quite interesting. We've found out that our teaching it doesn't overlap, but it does dovetail with some of the student activism. There's a big group in the university called Fossil Free Warwick who've worked to get the university to divest of its investments in the fossil fuels industry. And we've helped to advertise their events, and I think they've probably, some of their activists have come to our module and provided some extremely eloquent and involved and engaged seminar participants. So I think the two kinds of activity, the academic and the campaigning, go together and reinforce one another. I think that people go away with a much greater understanding and conviction that the basic science is right. I think they also go away with an awareness of the complexity of changing people's behavior, the incredible complexity of world economic life, and the extraordinary interdependence of things. One thing that on occasions we've talked about, and I think is quite important, is actually the unscrupulousness of some of the people who are denying it, and the way that there's been a systematic campaign of disinformation. It's very hard to understand the mindset of the people who are involved, but their behavior has been openly dishonest. There's a very interesting book called Merchants of Doubt, which is very readable, about the history of a small group of physicists in the US who have disputed practically everything you can think of. They've disputed the danger of smoking, they've disputed that smoking caused lung cancer, they've disputed that acid rain was caused by sulfur dioxide emissions from power stations, and they've disputed that acid rain is harmful, they've disputed that CFCs were damaging the ozone layer. Their research was always paid for by big companies, and they always had the ear of government, and they always succeeded in delaying legislation, and they've done the same again with regard to climate change. It's rather shocking, because you often think your opponents are honourable people, but these are not. So I think that's another useful lesson, that one should not expect honourable behaviour from big corporations. I don't want to come across as a fanatic. I mean, I'm not saying all corporations are wicked and evil and we must nationalise the means of production and blah, blah. I don't believe that, but I think we do need to be very, very vigilant and not trusting. And I think government needs to be very forceful, because I think this is a problem that is going to be solved by government through the pressure of people and not just by the unfettered market. And I think that's something that I hope students will also learn. All my life I've been kind of interested, I've been in some sense vaguely politically active. You know, I mean, not in the sense of belonging to the Labour Party or the Communist Party or anything, but just believing that it's my job, in a way, as an aware citizen to raise my voice about some things that have concerned me. And climate change has certainly been one. And then it must have been about 6 or 7 years ago, I had some contact with a young mathematician who was working in Kenya. He was developing mathematics in a university on the shores of Lake Victoria. And he invited me to a conference. And I thought, what topic can I talk about that will be open to a lot of people, that will not be too technically demanding? Because I know that the sort of stuff I do research on here just would be a closed book to most people. And there's no reason why they should be interested in it anyway. But I felt this was a topic that was accessible. So I put together a talk. And I felt that it was very convincing, actually. In the course of the talk, I came up with a phrase which I'm very proud of, where, I mean, I've used this many times. We always repeat the same jokes over and over again. But the idea is that it's not hard science that's going to solve the problem. It's not something that people should be afraid of because they don't know all this incredibly complex climate science. And the phrase is, it's not just rocket science, because all that very complicated stuff is somehow being taken care of. The problem is getting the public to buy into it, and that's a different matter, and I think that can be addressed by anybody. So that's one reason why I felt I was in a position to do this. You know, I'm not frightened of numerical subjects, so nobody's going to scare me by saying, oh, this is something that only scientists can talk about. I am a scientist. I know that there are people doing the stuff, and I know I don't need to. What I do need to do is try to develop education about this, and I'm in a position to do that. I know people in different departments because I've been here a long time, and it was easy. In fact, it was very easy to go around and phone up a friend in politics and say, look, who's in your department, who's interested in climate change? Email them, would you like to join in? Oh, yes, delighted. You know, and then somebody from law said, could I join your module as well? So, you know, there's lots and lots of interest. Lots of people want to do something about it. It's just a question of giving them the opportunity. I think that the academic career is a bit funny in certain ways. It doesn't encourage you to branch out from the area in which you've developed your expertise and where you've invested your time. I probably wouldn't be doing this at an earlier stage in my career. Well, I obviously didn't, but I think the problem itself wasn't so pressing. But I wouldn't have, you know, I probably was more concerned earlier on to get my publications, and now I'm less worried about that. And actually, the university is a fantastic opportunity for the kind of activity that I now find very fulfilling, with less worry about publication and more concern actually for education. Immediately after the end of the Paris conference, there were a lot of different assessments of what had happened. So amazingly, the European Union said, this is the first legally binding climate treaty, and put that on the website, and it's still there. But the response that I thought was the best was from James Hansen, who's a well-known climate scientist, and something of a maverick, because he's gone beyond writing about this in academic journals, and actually he's gone on demonstrations and been arrested. He said, as long as carbon continues to be, or fossil fuels continue to be the cheapest way of producing energy, they're going to continue being burnt. And that's really the key to it. What's needed is is a price for carbon. So people need to pay when they burn. Not just the cost of extracting and transporting the fuel, but the cost of the damage that that carbon is doing and will do. And now that's hard to calculate, but the International Monetary Fund, which is not traditionally regarded as a radical organization, has recently circulated a briefing paper estimating that the subsidy to the fossil fuel industry, which they receive through not paying for the damage that their product causes, is in the order of $5 trillion a year, which dwarfs the subsidies that are being paid to develop renewables. And if you think about it in those terms, then you see that really we're allowing them to get away with murder. A carbon tax would change that. If people paid the price of the damage as well as the costs of production and transport when they burn fossil fuels would cease to be the cheapest and renewables would come into their own and the problem could be solved. I mean, that's the astonishing thing. The problem could be solved. We have the technology, we have the ability, we just need the economics to work in our favor. And that's what governments need to do. And that won't happen at a grassroots level, but grassroots campaigners can spread awareness of the need for this and can promote it in their local political forums and press their MPs and their representatives, and I think that that's what we should be doing. I think that it's quite true that the value of the change that you make by switching off your lights or reducing your air travel is very small, but if you don't do that, then you're going to be denying your own awareness of the problem, and that denial will propagate in your consciousness, and basically you're likely to forget about it. So if you're concerned, you have to act in a way that you feel is just. I hope that if you're concerned and you start acting in a way that you believe is just, you will also spread that awareness, and your just actions will encourage others to behave justly. And you may also be developing new strategies for living justly. Perhaps instead of jetting off to the Maldives, you'll discover and help other people to see that going walking in the Warwickshire countryside is an enjoyable way of spending your holiday. I mean, it's not quite as sunny, but, you know, I mean, you can discover things and you can show people things and you can develop your own awareness. And even though it's a very small contribution, it will count. And you've got to multiply your own contribution by the number of other people who might follow or emulate or do the same thing as you at the same time because they're subject to the same influences as you. And so you should see yourself as part of a movement. But it's hard. We tend to be isolated individuals or isolated families or small groups, and we see our own activities as too insignificant, and that's very discouraging. So that's a big problem. That really is the powerlessness of the individual, and we need to find ways of combating that.
This podcast was recorded by Iggy and edited by Andamanita. Music by Incompetech in St. Lucia. You're listening to Elevate by St. Lucia.